Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Maggie Mullen. Today on the show, we'll hear about plans that the Bureau of Land Management has to increase the numbers of wild horses they remove from public land.
In a heartbeat, they're going to lose what they value most, and that's two things, family and freedom.
The University of Wyoming recently adopted a plan to help support Native American students on campus.
Leaving the reservation, first of all, to come to a predominantly white campus is a struggle.
And we'll have an entertaining discussion about what surgeries were like in the 19th century.
The surgeon rarely washed his hands or his instruments, and he carried around this cadaverous smell of rotting flesh, which they called good old hospital stink.
Those stories and more on Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. This is Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Maggie Mullen. This week, Wyoming Congresswoman Liz Cheney rebuked President Trump's strategy, or lack thereof, in Syria. And she's not alone, as correspondent Matt Laszlo reports from Washington.
Liz Cheney is now the number three most powerful Republican in the House of Representatives. And being a member of leadership usually means carrying the president's water and trying to get other Republicans to help do the same. But after Trump announced he was pulling U.S. troops from their posts in Syria, where they had been protecting the Kurds, Cheney helped spearhead legislation sanctioning Turkey, even as Trump loosened sanctions.
We've got to ensure that we do not have a resurgence of ISIS. I think that requires having a troop presence there.
Cheney now supports Trump's decision to keep a small contingent of forces in Syria to protect the nation's oil fields. And she's cheering this weekend's successful operation against the former leader of ISIS.
I'm glad that the president has decided not to withdraw all the forces. I think that the Baghdadi operation demonstrated why it's so crucial, both in terms of intelligence gathering capability, in terms of having forces on the ground who can respond quickly.
Even as Cheney refuses to criticize Trump directly, she's also been sounding different of late. She's actually praising Democratic leaders, which is basically unheard of from her.
And I'm glad that the Democrats are bringing the Armenian Genocide Resolution to the floor. The last time the Turks attempted to relocate as many people as they're talking about relocating now from Turkey into that buffer zone, you had the Armenian Genocide. I think it's important for us to make sure that we're sending a very clear signal, both in the sanctions resolution and in the genocide resolution, that we do not support what the Turks have done.
That's when Democrats are dubious.
I think a lot of Republicans want to rush to support a sanctions bill so that they can check a box.
That's Connecticut Democratic Senator Chris Murphy. His skepticism comes, in part, from Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell's refusal to say how he wants to proceed in response to the veto-proof House vote this week to sanction Turkey.
President Trump may not even implement sanctions. So I think we all need to be pretty sober-minded about the utility of sanctions right now. I think a lot of Republicans are very interested in supporting sanctions because it absolves them of the responsibility to try to convince this president to act differently.
Whether a smokescreen or not, even Wyoming Senator John Barrasso, who is also a Trump loyalist, is also fully on board with sanctions. He says Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan needs to be held in check, even if he seems to be trusted by Trump.
I support sanctions, tough sanctions on Turkey in an effort to get them to change their behavior, and specifically Erdogan. Erdogan has done things over the last dozen years that have not been in the best interest, I believe, of the United States or of NATO.
Barrasso especially complains of the military hardware Turkey has been buying from Russia recently.
He's taking Turkey in a direction that I think is the wrong direction. I think it is more favorable to Russia, to Syria, perhaps to Iran as well, and all of those things I think are harmful to the best interests of the United States.
But Virginia Democratic Senator Tim Kaine was at a classified briefing with Barrasso this week. Kaine says many lawmakers asked for the administration's overall strategy in the region, but they were never given a coherent or even any type of answer.
But they haven't given us their idea about what a strategy should be. And so they need to do it, and they need to do it quickly, because we're likely to take up this sanctions bill from the House or a Senate version of it fairly soon, and we don't have any guidance from the administration.
Still, Cheney and Barrasso are calling for Turkey to be reined in.
They're sure not acting like a friend and ally. Russia is trying to break Turkey away.
Whether Cheney, Barrasso, or the majority of Republicans, for that matter, have any sway with Trump on foreign policy issues remains to be seen. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Matt Laszlo in Washington.
On Tuesday, there will be a vote in Sheridan that has got a lot of attention. Wyoming Public Radio's Catherine Wheeler has been following the issue and joins us now. Catherine, what exactly is this all about?
So the city of Sheridan will hold a special election on Tuesday, November 5th, and that election seeks to answer whether Charter Ordinance 2202 should pass. Now, that ordinance seeks to update, if you will, the existing ordinance that established the city administrator position. 2202 has been described by most people as something that clarifies the responsibilities between the mayor and the city administrator, basically who does what.
Now, there are a lot of people that think this is going to decide if the mayor is in charge of the city or an administrator is in charge of the city. Is that what's happening here?
Well, not really. All that is being asked in this special election is if 2202, that updating of the responsibilities between the mayor and the city administrator, if that new one should take effect. Voting no in this election won't automatically get rid of the city administrator position. That's because the charter ordinance that established it, 2158, will still be on the books.
So what's the history of this issue?
Well, it kind of has a long history in Sheridan. Back in 2008, there was a special election about whether or not to establish a city administrator position. And at that time, the citizens voted no, that they didn't want one. They didn't want a city administrator. But the topic kept simmering throughout town. And then in 2015, the city council at the time decided that they were going to establish this position. And so they created Charter Ordinance 2158, which is the current existing law that establishes the city administrator position. But a lot of people didn't like it. They think that the city administrator position takes power away from the mayor. They think it takes away the mayor's ability to govern and to run the city. Sheridan Mayor Roger Miller actually kind of ran on this topic, saying that he wanted to bring back this strong mayor form of government. He wanted to be the one running the city, doing the day-to-day, knowing what was really happening and making those decisions. And earlier this year, the city council decided, okay, we're going to really study this issue and decide if the city administrator position is actually helping the city. And what came away from that subcommittee was that they did believe, yes, this is helping the city run more efficiently. And so what they did then was decided, okay, let's update the law that we already have. Let's clarify some of the responsibilities between the mayor and the city administrator. And that is what is being challenged at this special election.
Okay, so what's going on? What are the details? The election is Tuesday?
Yes. So the special election will be held on Tuesday, November 5th. 7 polling locations will be open throughout town, and those will be open from 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. Residents can pick up absentee ballots from the city clerk. The latest you can pick up one of those is 5 p.m. the day before the election, so November 4th. And then the absentee ballots just need to be returned to City Hall by the close of the polls at 7 p.m. on Election Day. From there, the city clerk will present the results of the election to the city council and to the city on November 7th at a special meeting that will begin at 5:30 p.m.
Okay, this is probably important to clarify, but if I vote yes, what am I doing?
You're voting in support of Charter Ordinance 2202. That's the one that clarifies the responsibilities between the mayor and the city administrator. If you're voting no, you're sticking with the original ordinance that created the position. But opponents to the city administrator position are saying that a no vote is all like a kind of symbolic gesture towards getting rid of the city administrator position entirely. But it's important to note that the city council doesn't have to go back to this issue if 2202 is voted down. They can just leave 2158 as it is and move on. But opponents to the position say that if it is voted down, it would be the opportunity for the city council to really take a hard look about if this is what the people of Sheridan want and if a city administrator position is right for the city of Sheridan.
Catherine Wheeler covers Northeast Wyoming for Wyoming Public Radio. Thank you.
Thank you.
When we come back, we'll hear how some at UW will try and keep a Native American student plan moving forward. This is Open Spaces.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Maggie Mullen. A committee at the University of Wyoming has been quietly toiling to finish a plan that would help Native American students feel more welcome and supported on campus. Wyoming Public Radio's Melody Edwards reports, committee members feel it's coming just in the nick of time since the university is getting ready to hire a new president.
Students gather in a sunny living room in the bright red house that serves as the Native American Center on the UW campus. They lounge on couches, bemoaning homework and all the usual college kid stuff. Northern Arapaho members Chelsea Badhawk and Dennis Makeshine say they don't know what they'd do without the hominess of this center.
Yeah, I probably wouldn't have decided to stay here if it wasn't here. I would have probably got really homesick and went home.
I do find myself kind of heading towards the center, like, pretty much every single day.
Groups organize events here. It's where they catch a quick snack between classes. It's home base, literally. It's also where they can get advice of any sort from the Native student advisor, Raynette Tendor. Her office is right off the living room, her door wide open.
As a Native student, when you're leaving the reservation, you look for somebody that can kind of support you through everything because of all just the unique needs and challenges that we face as Native people, leaving the reservation, first of all, to come to a predominantly white campus is a struggle.
And that struggle has been keeping Native students from applying to UW. In fact, when Tendor was a student here a few years ago, she was only one of six Native students. Then President Nichols came along and made it a priority to increase that. She visited the tribes in person often and set a goal to help the Native student population reflect the state's actual Native population. And it worked. The latest numbers aren't in, but Tendor says Native student enrollment is way up. But then last spring, the UW Board of Trustees opted not to renew Nichols' contract. Northern Arapaho Council Chairman Lee Spoonhunter.
We were shocked and disheartened due to the fact that she has just worked hand in hand with us and really sat down at the table and really just tried to identify barriers that Northern Arapaho tribal members go through when trying to get an education.
Spoonhunter says right now that's a huge issue for his tribe, since 40% of its members are under 18 years old and in search of workforce training. Shoshone and Arapaho member James Trosper is now the director of the High Plains American Indian Research Institute. But he was also a student and a board of trustee at UW. In these roles, he's seen a lot of presidents come and go, and with them, a commitment to Native student advocacy.
The work that and the dedication that President Nichols had is off the charts in regards to her support for Native American issues and affairs. And it's going to be difficult for anybody that follows in her shoes to have that level of support.
Trosper says now that Nichols is gone, tribal leaders want to see support for Native issues rise above the fluctuating personalities in leadership. He's hopeful that that's just what the Native American and Indigenous Affairs Strategic Plan will do. Ken Giroux is the advisory council's chairman.
I'm taking it as part of my personal agenda to make this as a matter of fact. This is part of what UW does, Mr. or Mrs. President, whoever that is, and get behind us because we're rolling.
Giroux says the plan got input from Wind River tribes and set big goals to improve things, like the faculty's sensitivity training, and to conduct more research relevant to tribes. And as law professor Jason Robison says, it has grander goals, too.
To be blunt, advocacy suggested in the plan for the appointment of at least one Native representative on the UW Board of Trustees. Further, advocacy for appointment of Native colleagues in leadership positions.
But Eastern Shoshone Council Vice Chairman Leslie Shakespeare just wants to know that all this great progress isn't going to disappear. The plan is only 5 years, and then another one will have to be drafted.
You know, there's that change, there's that uncertainty, and then you feel like, well, is this plan really going to mean anything, or is it just going to be words on paper because we're not sure if an administrative change is going to share that same goal and values that that plan was created out of.
Angela Jaime, director of UW's Native American Indigenous Studies program, shares some of those concerns. She points out that the plan doesn't have any direct financial support behind it, for instance. But she says the plan does take the long view, such as planning for the construction of a new Native American center when it outgrows the Red House, which is happening fast. She says it also ensures the systems are in place to replace her and others. The main thing, Jaime says, is that the plan leads to long-term institutional support for UW's Native community.
The need for there to be an appreciation for the Indigenous people of this land is paramount. And it will only benefit our students, our Native students, when the state shows, yes, we value you, and we'll make sure that it doesn't go away, and we'll make sure that whoever we hire as the president of the university, the only university in the state, will support you.
The University Board of Trustees hopes to select the new president by next spring. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Melody Edwards.
Lander writer and photographer Sarah Wiles has been spending time with families on the Wind River Reservation and taking pictures of them since the 1970s. She has a new book out called The Arapaho Way. She says it's the culmination of those 40-plus year relationships and a way of documenting the reservation's contemporary history. Wyoming Public Radio's tribal affairs reporter Savannah Marr sat down with Wiles and asked about some of her favorite images in the book.
Gee, it's like picking out your favorite grandkid or something, you know. I do have one here I really like. This is Nora Oldman during the grand entry to powwow, you know, just before sundown, bright sun. And I like this picture because she's got a washcloth on her head. So everybody else here is dressed fancy, and she's dressed in a real plain traditional dress with a wash rag on her head. I like that picture a lot. I mean, there's a lot like that that I... These here are documentary pictures, and this is really interesting, too. In 2015, two Arapaho men were shot in Riverton. Have you heard about that story?
Yeah, okay. I have.
Yeah.
Especially in light of the shooting that just happened in Riverton. It's something that has come up quite a bit, actually.
Mm-hmm. Good. I'm glad that people are still remembering that. A couple of weeks after the shooting, an Arapaho man named Ron Howard and others, too, organized a peace march in Riverton because the tensions were running high. And then one of the men who was shot in Riverton survived. His name is James Goggles Jr., known as Sonny. So there's pictures in here of Sonny when he came back to the reservation. He was in the Veterans Administration Hospital in Sheridan for quite a while, and they brought him back about a year after the shooting for an honoring ceremony and a dinner. He had to have help walking because there's a bullet in his head. And so he has trouble in several ways, one of which is walking steadily. So all that's in the book. So I'm hoping that that'll be good documentation.
I think that's something that people here really value, because one of the complaints mm-hmm. that I hear about photography of Native people and mm-hmm. writing about Native people is mm-hmm. that there's quite a bit of interest in history, mm-hmm. meaning things that happened 100 years ago or more.
Yeah, not the day-to-day stuff and the hard stuff. And yeah,
exactly.
I know
yeah.
exactly what you mean.
And that's a lot of these photos mm-hmm. in your book.
Right, yeah. And stuff happens. You know, bad stuff happens. Of course, good stuff happens too. But
yeah.
So anyway, so that's that. I mean, there's just a whole bunch of stuff in here.
It's of great interest to me as a person who is not from here, who's mm-hmm. trying to document certain parts of life on Wind River, mm-hmm. how you reached a point with these families where they were willing to have you photograph them and willing mm-hmm. to share these stories with you.
Mm-hmm. Well, it was a long process. just taking a few pictures here and there, you know, usually of people I knew well. And then the one thing I did from the very beginning was always give lots of copies to people, you know, because I think there's this idea that people come to take, you know, they come to take your picture and then they're taking it away and that's the last you know about it.
And over the years, have you ever had any pushback? Anyone who said that a white woman is not the right person to be documenting these things?
I think, you know, it was, again, I'd been here so long, and it was such a gradual process. By the time it got to the point of having the books, people were real used to me. So I was really careful, and I'm sure there's people out there, you know, who gripe about it. Anything you do in any community, somebody's going to complain about. But I haven't had a lot of that kind of feedback.
So in these photos and in this writing, these stories that people have shared with you can really feel the intimacy that you have with these families and how you've really come to be, in a lot of ways, a part of these families. And, you know, rural communities and rural Native communities especially have sort of a reputation for being sort of insular and difficult to enter as an outsider. But I think the flip side of that is sort of evident in your book, that once you do build that trust and make yourself a part of the community, it's a community and an acceptance like nothing else.
It's real hard for me to articulate that because it's just been my life for so long. I know more people on the reservation and am engaged in more activities and events on the reservation than I am in Lander, where I live. For years and years, I had people in Lander ask me, why do you want to do that? Why do you want to go out there? Is it safe for you to go out there? And I stopped trying to answer those questions and be around a lot of those people because I just didn't want to deal with that attitude. Anyway, it's an odd life I've had. Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for taking some time to talk with me about it.
Oh, yeah. Well, thank you for coming over.
That's Lander writer and photographer Sarah Wiles discussing her new book, The Arapaho Way. Savannah Marr is a Report for America Corps member.
Coming up, a story about an increased effort to gather horses on public land. This is Open Spaces. Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Maggie Mullen.
And I'm Bob Beck. The acting director of the Bureau of Land Management says the overpopulation of wild horses is the biggest challenge in managing public lands. William Perry Penley says the BLM needs to increase the number of wild horses it removes from public lands by about 61,000. But their method of doing this is controversial. Wyoming Public Radio's Camila Kudelska takes us to one of those gathers.
The sun is just rising as a group of people struggle out of their cars and start getting their things put together. We are about 35 miles northwest of Warland. BLM Public Affairs Specialist Sarah Beckwith is in charge of the 18 members of the public who have come to observe the 15-mile wild horse gather.
This is our hill. You can see the jute, obviously, at the top. That's what we will be hunkered down behind when the horses are in the area, when the helicopters are in the area.
Wild horse roundups are a management tool used by the BLM to reduce the number of horses on public land. What the BLM tries to do is use a helicopter to herd horses into a corral. They will later try to adopt these horses out. According to the agency, the animals have no natural predators, so they reproduce quickly, and the land can't support such a high number of horses.
We are potentially gathering up to 700. 100 will be returned to the herd management area, so only if we do gather 700, 600 would be shipped.
The BLM says the 15-mile wild horse herd should be closer to 200 rather than its current level of 700.
Is it just a helicopter?
No, there's a whole bunch of horses just out in there. Yeah. I think it's at least 40.
I'm crouched behind the brown netting or jute next to Ginger Catherine's. She is part of a nonprofit dedicated to the preservation of wild horses and burros. She, like some other people observing the gather, do not approve of rounding wild horses, especially by helicopter.
In a heartbeat, they're going to lose what they value most. And that's two things, family and freedom.
We sit and watch as the horses gallop through the Badlands, kicking up red dust, passing sand boots, right until they run into a V-shaped trap that leads them right into corrals contractors have set up about a mile and a half away. All the while, the helicopter is close by.
One reason they put us so far away is when you're over there and they run them in, you can see the bodies crashing and you can hear the sounds and you can feel the terror and hear them screaming.
Catherine's and others like her don't disagree that wild horse populations are too big to manage, but she calls these gathers inhumane and thinks they should focus on preventing birth.
There's ways to do this with, you know, various different kinds of safe vaccines. PZP is the time-tested one. It's been used for several decades.
The BLM does manage some horses with birth control, says Jason Litterman with the BLM. But he says the most common drug, PZP, only lasts 1 to 2 years.
We would be conducting those gathers every year, every other year in order to give a booster of that fertility control to that mare in order to maintain that infertility. And you can imagine that comes with its own suite of logistical and budgetary issues.
Letterman says the agency is investing in developing better, long-lasting fertility vaccines, but they just don't exist yet.
The best way to manage the populations is to still gather and adopt out the excess animals while using fertility control where we can and where it can be effective.
In 6 days, 607 animals were gathered and 95 were returned back to the management area. And there were 11 deaths. The BLM says that leaves approximately 107 horses on the land. The rest have been transferred to off-range corrals in Rock Springs. Scott Fleur with the BLM says they will first try to adopt them out.
Excess horses that are unadoptable will go to private ranches under contract with the Bureau of Land Management, and those horses will go on pasture and live their lives out there on a pasture setting on private land.
The BLM says the number of adoptions has slightly increased recently, but they are nowhere near the numbers they need to have a completely successful program. So, in the near future, the helicopter gathers are likely to continue. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Camila Gadalska at the Center of the West in Cody.
Farmers across the country are feeling the backlash of the trade war with China, and while there have been recent steps towards resolving that, the national farm economy hasn't fared well. But as the Mountain West News Bureau's Madeline Beck found, our region is an exception.
Drew Eggers was at the edge of one of his stubble fields when he plucked a patch of mint left over from harvest.
And you can smell.
Oh, yeah.
Smell the spearmint.
This is his 41st year farming out on Black Cat Road in southwest Idaho. It's also his last year.
Two weeks ago, I rented the farmland out to other farmers, and so we're starting retirement.
He's seen plenty of ups and downs with crops ranging from mint to corn to beans, His last year was pretty good, and he attributes that to planning.
You know, a farmer anywhere needs to be a good business manager.
And it was a good year for a lot of Mountain West farmers. Part of the reason farmers here are doing well is because of what they grow and where they send it.
I think generally it helps a state to have a more diverse mix.
That's Carrie Litkowski. She's with the U.S. Department of Agriculture's Economic Research Service. She says with diversity,
they're not as vulnerable to price changes for a particular commodity.
She says farmers in our region grow a variety of big crops, but Midwest farmers tend to focus on just two, corn and soybeans. And soybeans took the biggest hit from the trade war, as China is our biggest customer for that crop. Another advantage for our region is what's happening with the dairy market right now. They'd seen lots of overproduction, but some of that production fell this last year, which meant prices went up. Rick Narabout is CEO of the Idaho Dairymen's Association.
Just recently, milk prices have gone above the break-even level to where our dairymen are starting to, you know, make back some of that money that they lost over the last 4 years.
Still, the future is hazy, like most of the ag sector right now. That's according to Michael Neveu, an economist with the American Farm Bureau.
I hate trying to make any kind of forecast in the current political and trade environment. It's one of those things that can change with a single tweet.
But here's an important thing to note. If you compare overall net income between the Mountain West and the Midwest, both look like they're doing okay. But right now, Midwest farms are being propped up with federal aid, and even with that financial help, the rate of farm bankruptcies there are going up faster. Still, overall, Neveu says farm debt across the nation is generally climbing more quickly than the value of what farmers own.
Which means your debt-to-asset ratios are going what we would consider the wrong direction.
And then there's the weather. It's also a bit of a crapshoot. Torrential rains and flooding hit already struggling Midwest farmers this year. Last year's hurricane season wasn't great for the Southeast. But here in the Mountain West, while there's always the threat of drought, we had a pretty good year. And that's a big deal in Mountain West states, where ag plays a major role in state economies. Garth Taylor is an economist with the University of Idaho. He does a yearly report on how ag is expected to do in the state. This last year, he thought Idaho farmers' net incomes would keep slipping.
And when USDA put out their numbers in September, we found delightfully that we were wrong.
Net incomes were nearly 90% higher than projected. And it wasn't trade wars that threw them off. It was day-to-day costs. Prices for fuel turned up lower than expected. And in turn, fertilizer and farm operations did too. That's all it took for the balance to shift between another down year and a regional resurgence. For the Mountain West News Bureau, I'm Madeline Beck.
Grizzly bears of the Yellowstone ecosystem are again protected by the Endangered Species Act. That means Wyoming Game and Fish manages the bears as normal, but the final decision has to be okayed by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. Fall is usually the time of year the most human-bear conflicts occur because recreationists are out and bears are getting ready to hibernate. Wyoming Public Radio's Camila Kudelska speaks with Dan Thompson, the department's large carnivore supervisor, about how grizzly management is changing as the grizzly population footprint is expanding.
We have expansion all along the eastern edge of the Absaroka front, of course. And we've had roadside bears next to state highways that they haven't been for hundreds of years. It's difficult because obviously you don't expect someone in those areas of expansion to be as prepared as someone who lives in the core of the ecosystem where there's different regulations at play. We deal with the conservation of bears, but mostly we deal with people management. So.
And by people management, you mean just like how to not attract bears?
Yeah, just a ton of outreach and education and trying to dispel myths that are out there. And, you know, there's so much misinformation that can get promulgated immediately nowadays. Our goal is always to try to reduce that conflict potential. But with the population levels where they're at, there's always that potential. And we're going to be dealing with conflicts on an annual basis. And we've done a lot of work to reduce those in areas. But as they expand and continue to expand, you know, it's always an issue trying to resolve issues in a human dominated landscape.
Are there more bears going into like conflicts with livestock and with just food that's available, does it seem, this year? Because they are expanding to more human-dominated areas?
Yeah, we've definitely seen a shift in the types of conflicts. And if you look at a long enough scale, everything's going to evolve. But we used to have a lot more property damage and site conflicts. We were able to deal with those by securing attractants and things like that in the recovery zone. As bears move beyond the recovery zone, there's more things available for them. As they move beyond suitable habitat, and there's even more potential for conflict. So we've definitely seen a shift into more livestock depredations, but we've actually seen a decrease in some of those property damage and things like that in the core of the system, where we've been able to secure attractants better and do a lot of outreach. I mean, the public ownership is also the reason we're at where we're at with recovery and beyond recovery. And so without that, we wouldn't be there.
Can you kind of go into how you guys decide whether to relocate or euthanize the grizzlies?
The strong majority of the situations, until we have an animal in hand, we don't know what the decision is going to be. We factor into our consideration everything we know. We look at, is it a bear we've previously handled? Does it have a conflict history? What type of conflict it was? Do we have a suitable relocation site if it is a relocation animal? I think there's a misconception that we're moving dangerous bears. If we feel there's a bear out there that we have in hand that's a direct threat to human safety, it's not going to get relocated. We're gonna actually request to lethally remove that animal or find placement for it. But an animal that's food or that's conditioned or a direct threat to human safety is not something that we would ever put back on the landscape.
And then when you guys decide to relocate a bear, it seems that you guys are relocating them like just within the DMA, so kind of like the Cody Sunlight Basin area. Since they're expanding, doesn't it mean they're just going to continue to expand because there's a lot of bears there already?
Well, yeah, the notion with relocation is that depending on the type of conflict, you're giving that individual another chance in an area that doesn't have that conflict potential. So if we move a bear, we're going to move it back into the recovery area, so into the core of the system. We're going to also put a bear in a remote area that doesn't have that conflict potential available. And what we've seen through the years, obviously, is with the higher density of bears, they tend to go back to where they were caught. And so as we have more bears, we're not running out of relocation sites because they're pretty much the same as they have been. It's just we're seeing a lot more recidivism and bears returning. It's still a very viable management option and a very viable conservation tool. But as we have more bears, the options become more limited.
But it isn't posing a problem yet to like being there's no place to relocate them.
Well, and the efficacy of doing it is becoming more difficult. We're still classified as a threatened population. So that's despite the fact that we're fully biologically recovered, we still have some constraints on those things. But we're all trying to have some flexibility to do what's best for bears and what's best for people. And so all those factors are taken into consideration for any management actions that we take.
Okay. Well, thank you so much, Dan.
Yep.
In a moment, we'll wrap up the program learning about how ugly surgeries used to be. This is Open Spaces. Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Maggie Mullen.
And I'm Bob Beck. You know, there was a time when surgeries were a spectacle and one of the most unsanitary events you've ever seen. That's until a doctor named Joseph Lister changed their ways. Author Lindsay Fitzharris came to the University of Wyoming this week to discuss her award-winning and gory book, The Butchering Art. How much fun was surgery way back when?
Not very fun at all. You know, I call it the original fear factor, if anybody's watched that television show. Being strapped to the operating table without any anesthesia, and certainly before we understood germ theory, was awful. These operations were nothing more than slow-moving executions. They were really painful, and of course, the post-operative infection rate was very high.
Did they ever work? I mean, obviously some people survived.
Yeah, yeah. Some people, it's hard to know mortality rates because this is before hospital statistics. And a lot of surgeons didn't want to admit when their patients were dying in high numbers. But certainly it did work sometimes. But again, the surgeon, my book, The Butchering Art, is really about the moment that germ theory becomes accepted into medicine, which is a hugely critical moment. Because before then, the surgeon rarely washed his hands or his instruments. And he carried around this cadaverous smell of rotting flesh, which they called good old hospital stink. So these places didn't just look different or feel different, they smelt different. And the surgeon, he didn't wash his hands because he didn't understand germ theory. So why would you wash your hands in between patients if they were just going to get dirty again? And as a result, post-operative infection was so high, and these people were dying in incredible numbers in these hospitals.
Dr. Joseph Lister had been studying this for a long time, and is he the one that essentially discovered germs?
So, yeah, my book is about Joseph Lister, and if you're out there and you're wondering why that name sounds familiar and you're not sure why, it's because of the product Listerine. So Lister was a British surgeon, and he came to Philadelphia in the 1860s, and he gave this talk about antisepsis and germ theory, and there was a man in the audience who was inspired by Lister, and he created this product, Listerine. It wasn't used as a mouthwash in the 19th century. It was actually used more commonly to treat STDs. So not something that I endorse, but certainly something that Listerine was originally used for. But Lister is the father of antiseptic surgery. So what he did was he took Louis Pasteur's germ theory and he applied it to medical practice. It's the first time that a scientific principle was ever applied to medical practice. So I like to call this book the love story between science and medicine. It's the birth of scientific surgery.
And to be clear, as you said before, they didn't do anything, didn't wash their hands. And you have a quote from a doctor who said, in fact, gentlemen don't pass diseases on?
Yes, that's absolutely right. In fact, the cover of my book is a famous painting by a man named Thomas Eakins, and it's called The Gross Clinic because the man on it is Samuel Gross, and he so didn't believe in Lister, he so didn't believe in germs that he would slam the door behind him and he would say, there, Mr. Lister's germs can't get in anymore. And so he really just, and you can see it in this painting, he's wearing his street clothes, they're sticking their filthy fingers into this wound. There's a woman in that painting, she's wearing black and covering her face. She is the mother of the patient. She's wearing black because she expects her son to die. So this was really an awful period. And in fact, it was so bad that it was seriously suggested the only way to control hospital infection was to burn the hospitals down from time to time and just start anew. And so you think about this critical period and Joseph Lister stepping into the scene. It was very hard for people to accept germ theory. And it's hard for us to understand that today. But if you imagine this young guy telling you that there are these invisible little creatures and they exist and they're killing your patients and you need to do these kinds of methods to prevent this from happening, it was a hard pill for surgeons to swallow.
Well, let's have some fun here. So tell us a little bit about what an operating room might look like if I was to have surgery.
Yes. Well, one of my favorite spaces is the old operating theater in London. It's the second oldest in the world. It still exists. And these were incredibly small spaces, sort of a semicircular stands around the operating table, and they would have been filled to the rafters with ticketed spectators. People actually bought tickets to see the life and death struggle play out before them. And of course, the Victorians were carrying the grime and dirt of everyday life with them. So these were very unsterile, unhygienic places. Before the discovery of ether in 1846, the patient would have been very alert. There is this kind of myth that the patient would have been drunk, but actually alcohol would make your blood thinner. So you certainly wouldn't want the patient to be drinking too much before an operation. And they were restrained. Sometimes before ether, they were sat in a chair, a very high chair, so that your feet dangled so you couldn't brace against the knife.
What would an amputation be like? What would happen there?
One of my favorite stories is a guy named Robert Liston. Robert Liston was the fastest knife in the West End. He was 6'2". He could hold you down with his left arm, and he could take off your leg in under 30 seconds, which is exactly what you'd want your surgeon to do in a pre-anesthetic era. Now, in order to remove the leg, so if you ever see a Victorian operating table, they tend to be very low to the ground. And people think that's because the Victorians were shorter, which there's an element of that. But actually, when you want to take the leg off, when you start to saw, you're going to want to push your body into it. So you don't want the table to be too high. You don't want to cut it like you would cut a steak. So these tables were very low. And actually, the Victorians understood that very well. They would push into the amputation. They obviously, you can imagine, it was very bloody. They had these hooks that they had to pull the arteries down to tie them off. And all of that in under 30 seconds is a pretty incredible feat.
So how did Lister make me get people around to his way of thinking?
It was a long, slow burn. I'm trying to get this movie made. I joke that I'm going into Hollywood and trying to convince them that a Quaker surgeon from the 19th century deserves a Hollywood feature. But he's so important. He saved more lives than any other person to ever live, because if you extrapolate what we do today, knowing now about germ theory. But he really, he turned to the younger generation, and he was able to change their hearts and minds. And they became known as the Listerians, and they went out and they spread the gospel of Lister. And that's ultimately how the change happened. But it took 20, 30 years, and it happened slower in America than it did in other parts of Europe.
Your book, by all the reviews, is viewed as gross, and you've got some very exotic detail. You want to give us one good story before we let you go?
This will probably be the thing that gets cut. I'll tell this story. Going back to Robert Liston, so he used to hold these knives, these bloody knives, in his mouth as he was switching instruments to really underline how far we've come. And one time, as he was operating so quickly, he accidentally took off his assistant's finger, and as he was switching blades, he cut the coat of a spectator. And it was said that the assistant died of gangrene, the patient died of gangrene, and the spectator died right then and there of fright. And it's jokingly referred to as the only operation with a 300% mortality rate. So if you're going to fail, you should fail big.
This is called The Butchering Art. This is a book that has won a lot of awards. Congratulations on all of this, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me on.
That was Dr. Lindsay Fitz-Harris discussing her book, The Butchering Art.
When StoryCorps came to Jackson last summer, Sarah Ross sat down with her mother, Alexandra Fuller, to discuss an article she wrote in the Jackson paper about her teenage experience with sexual assault.
Where did I go wrong, and where did I as a mother protect a narrative that was so damaging to you? Like, where was I unable to see that you were caught in a story that you didn't want to be in, even though you were, on paper, we were doing great. You were an honest student, and you were on a sports team, and you were doing all these things that are supposed to protect you against being, you know, harassed.
When I think about when I was 14 and my sort of first really messy sexual experiences happened, and I just remember this like sweetness and excitement just being curdled.
Yeah.
And it got so dark and so bad right away. And so I would have and gone to you with like my first kiss, but my first kiss never happened.
Oh God, Sarah.
You know, because it was so bad. But what's interesting about that is you had no idea that was going on, because I couldn't really accept that it was happening. But in truth, you had a lot that was going on.
That I couldn't accept was happening.
Yeah.
This is the truth. unless we heal our own bodies,
yeah.
our contempt and, you know, disdain for other bodies will continue, because it's self-contempt and self-disdain.
Yeah.
Not to love yourself enough to know what consent is and know what a boundary is. But when do we teach that? You know, and I think that's what you're doing, is you're calling everyone to account. Under our shiny, glossy surface, we've got a drunken mess of kids hurting each other, grown-ups hurting each other.
And I just have this sense that I can't move on with my life. I can't leave Jackson. I can't leave our family until I've done this work.
That's Sarah Ross and her mother, Alexandra Fuller, talking at StoryCorps in Jackson. This piece was produced by Alex Schaefer. Thanks for listening to Open Spaces. If you missed part of the show or want to hear an individual segment again, you can find it on our website at wyomingpublicmedia.org. Just click on Open Spaces.
You can also go to that website and sign up for a podcast, or get it wherever you get your podcasts. Anna Rader is our web editor. By the way, we're always interested to hear your ideas for future segments or interviews. You can contact us via the web or on Facebook. Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News.